And unfortunately, I think that there's been an atmosphere created where people are hesitant to even try to explain them because they'll have their head chopped off. But there you have it. Put it out there.
Thinking about, you know, as a Gainesville native growing up in this town and thinking about my own backyard and the backyards of places that I thought would be cool to live as I grew up, which I grew up in Audubon Park, and I always admired the duck pond. And these were all places where there was not irrigation and where there was a lot of native plants and where there was still really good property value. How can we take the lessons from old Gainesville and even East Gainesville, where, you know, we have low-income housing that does not have irrigation, that does not have high-impact landscaping? How can we take those lessons and make them valuable for new development? Any thoughts there? I know you're an old Gainesville person there, Bob, and I remember what you did to your yard 30-something years ago.
Yeah, I like what I did. I don't know if everybody else likes it. I think the snakes lived in my yard longer than they did in anybody else's. But there are all sorts of things. I mean, you don't. I haven't watered my yard in a couple of years. I haven't fertilized it in 40 years. And I have a nice lawn. And I'm able to do that because I don't mow it down close. I raise the lawnmower up as high as it'll go, and I don't mow it very often. Partly because I'm lazy, but partly because it works better. The less often you mow it and the less close you mow it, the less you're going to have to fertilize it or water it or care for it, the fewer bugs you're going to have or whatever. So there's some management tricks to turf management, for one thing. Choice of plants. There are some plants that require a lot of water and some don't. Mine's a Darwinian yard. All those that required a lot of water were gone a long time ago. So it selected it out. But anyway, I don't know if that answered the question at all.
I thought you might like to say it. But how can we take that lesson? Is it purely education? Is it incentives? Is it showcasing tours of houses that have sustainable practice like that and letting people see them? What are some ways that we can take those practices and propagate them out through new development, through west side development?
Well, you know, education is certainly a key, but that's this is way out of my field of expertise. I know I think the city of Gainesville gives certification for green certification for landscapes. And my daughter and son-in-law just built a house and did a landscape, and they were about to get awarded a green certification for landscapes until they noticed two invasive exotics in the yard, a camphor tree, which they're not willing to cut down, and some Boston fern, which they were willing to get rid of. So they couldn't get it because of an invasive exotic. What those people didn't realize is there were about six other invasive exotics that they didn't recognize. So they weren't even close.
Was that, Florida Yards and Neighborhoods?
It's a yard that's not threatening. It's in the middle of, it's on the edge of the Duck Pond neighborhood toward Main Street, between the Duck Pond neighborhood and Main Street. And those invasive exotics aren't going to hurt anything. They're not going to escape into some natural area or something. So the important thing was that their yard is designed not to use much water or fertilizer, and it is good green landscaping. So maybe the rules need to be looked at a little bit.
You know, Mark talked about having mavericks. I think one of the things that come to mind, that I think recently the county took the position of, phasing out irrigation. I think that's a great, great way of getting this conversation started. Hopefully everything looks good in a year, 2 years, 3 years, so people feel like they can follow suit. But, I mean, I think what we see happen over and over again, not just in our county or in the state, but on national levels, we basically wait until we get to a crisis mode before we do anything. And so I think the things like the county trying to phase out irrigation on their lands is a great step in that way, trying to get away from that practice without, you know, sometimes doing the incentivizing or de-incentivizing certain practices, even though I completely agree with a lot of them. Most of the time, I think the problem is, you know, you get into scenarios where people say they're economically disadvantaged or something, so if they gotta pay additional amounts of money for that water, it's gonna create a hardship, and I think that's hard to overcome sometimes. And, you know, I think in, was it 2012, we were about a month away from, you know, real change in water policy all across the state, and then the spigot broke loose and the rains came back. But, you know, I think unfortunately that's sort of where we're headed in general in the state. But I think, you know, the county or the city kind of coming in and changing practices ahead of those kind of crises is a good way of getting the conversation started and maybe getting other people to think about doing the same.
Just a real quick solution. I saw it work in another county, I think it was Pinellas County, where they have no mow zones. And so what the idea would be is that they have parks where they figure out where the traffic area is low, and they say, okay, we're not going to mow this area, and the money that's saved, they calculate that out, and they buy plants and other things and restore the area, and they have they call it no-mow zones. And that's one idea the county and the city could do, just say, hey, let's just identify that, calculate how much money we save for not mowing it, and put it into restoration. That's a demonstration for native landscaping in the city and the county.
I like that solution. And I think one of the big problems, of course, is homeowners associations and the constraints in new development that, you know, the county doesn't want to take care of new development, so they make homeowners associations, so they have to take care of new developments. And so then those rules get written by the developers to sell the houses, so, and people think those rules need to be there in order to maintain the property value. So that's sort of a vicious cycle. But if we're talking about where we are with existing homes, because right now we already have a whole lot of houses in Alachua County that have problems now. We talk about conservation easements and conservation lands, and what if there were incentives to conserve in terms of not mowing, not watering, on a very small basis, on a yard basis, and how that might feed back into a solution? Is that or maybe not mowing as much? We don't want to say not mowing at all. That could be a bad thing. But, you know, Bob's method, I mean, how does that, you know, is there any way we could incentivize that as a solution without the amount of education that would probably have to go into that would be massive, quite frankly. I feel like it would be.
You know, one thing that occurred to me as Bob was talking, because I'm not going to pretend to do my own lawn. My husband does it, but we don't have a lawn service. We do it ourselves. But all of our pretty much adjacent neighbors do have lawn services. But so I do think that there's perhaps a way to make substantial improvement, not by going out to the masses, but working with those larger lawn services that do maintain. I mean, the other thing that drives me nuts is the blowing. Just the
mow and blow.
Yeah, because it's just the noise. Yeah. And I keep thinking, couldn't we get all of the neighbors to just have their service done on one day so I could not be here for all this blowing? So there's I think that there may be a way to work through the lawn services to try to make substantial improvement there.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. And, you know, what would be their incentive, I guess, would be maintaining what is considered an acceptable lawn for less work and the same amount of money. So then we just have to get past the homeowners association, right? What I don't know how familiar any of you are with the current comp plan. Have you, any of you, any ideas of current comp plan things that need to be changed, or do we feel like our current comp plan is good enough? Is this
well? I mean, there's lots of suggestions, but I mean, I think after reading, I actually read it the other night. I
said, you read the whole thing?
No, I skimmed through it. I picked out some parts. Yeah, that's right. But I was amazed. There's a lot of language in there that does speak to conservation and natural resources. What I think needs to be inserted in there is maybe just a stick, but just a little bit more emphasis on regulation and perhaps some incentives that put those really good thoughts into some action. And with that, I'm thinking that there needs to be, the one thing I do see that missing, even though they said there's supposed to be a management plan when you talk about open space and all that, there's no funding associated with that. We really need some mechanism that says, how do you manage land over time?
Any thoughts there on a solution for that?
Well, that was the two special taxes.
One solution, yep.
Yeah. One for special assessment or with the homeowner association.
Yeah, and I'll say that's dramatically easier to do with a brand new development. I mean, I'm obviously much more familiar with the city's comprehensive plan, and the city didn't have a whole lot of brand new developments coming in wholesale. There were some, but you know, what is the greater challenge, I think, in the city is how do you improve sort of the quality of life across the city without, you know, and increase density and make, you know, the kind of mixed use environment that people don't have to be entirely dependent on the automobile without disrupting the peaceful enjoyment of those who are already living there. And that's it's a very, very difficult thing to do. There's no sort of simple, oh, do this. It takes, and you know, I recently was in a community that I was really impressed by, and sometimes it does take a few really maverick individuals who are willing to kind of stick their neck out and demonstrate, oh, you know, this can work, and here's how we can make this work.
I'd like to make one point about the county comprehensive plan. Most comprehensive plans are attempt to regulate growth, they attempt to reduce urban sprawl, they attempt to make the plan sort of plan the way development goes so that it's more economical, more efficient, and that sort of thing. But there's very few of them that proactively attempt to conserve valuable wildland, natural resources. And Alachua County's plan made an attempt at that by having the KBM folks identify the most valuable natural lands in the county and then designating them with a special designation of strategic ecosystems and having more stringent rules for those, such that wetlands couldn't be done away with and only half of what wasn't wetland could be developed. The other half, in other words, development had to be concentrated, clustered, so that half of those lands would be conserved and half, you know, so development could still happen, but it was a proactive attempt to conserve water resources, wildlife resources, natural areas, and so on. And I think that's, you know, it's not perfect, but I think it's a pretty good thing.
On the, one of the questions that we've had from the audience has to do with ecotourism. And of course, you know, this county is driven a lot by gator tourism. And so where is the disconnect between eco and tourism for Alachua County? Is it sometimes counterproductive? Is the eco balanced with the human impact of tourism in this county? And is there something we should do about that?
I'll take a stab at that. When I think of, you know, our traditional places, we think of ecotourism, internationally anyways, Costa Rica and the massive impact. You know, I don't necessarily see that when I go out. I can't give you numbers on that or anything like that. I think the one place where you see a real issue with it there, and I think, you know, one of the projects just got completed, the Sheetwater Sheetflow Project, might alleviate that. But the one place I think where you actually see where, if you want to call it ecotourism, where there's like a pretty, I think, substantial impact on wildlife, in some cases, and also, you know, the human ability to sort of enjoy that experience is Alachua Trail. I mean, without doubt, one of my favorite places. It's, you know, if you got family here for a short period of time, that's where you take them, because that's where you're guaranteed to see a gator. But I do think it's one of those places where you actually see where, you know, you see some of these issues where in Costa Rica we're sort of degrading the environment or the experience due to the result of just the sheer number of people out there. And I think, you know, hopefully with the Sheep Flow Project being closer to Gainesville than having to drive all the way over to the Lashua Trail, that may reduce some of that impact. And maybe some of, you know, it's I'm not a wildlife, you know, psychologist or anything, but, you know, maybe reduce some of that, you know, strain or stress on some of the experiences out there. And I think one of the biggest concerns, you know, obviously being a lawyer and running an organization, anytime you have, you know, lands that are open to the public, that we have to be thinking about is, you know, killing the golden goose. And the Lashua Trail, I think that's, you know, case in point, because, you know, people are constantly coming up to alligators and trying to get right up on them, not really recognizing that, you know, in a second it could be over for them. And then, you know, potentially being shut down or having to do guided trails and stuff like that. So from a, you know, I kind of keep harboring on that, but I think that's a big point of it. I don't think we're anywhere near a point, though, in this community where ecotourism has hit a point where it's really damaged. And I guess the Springs would be a good example, too, although some of those aren't actually in Alachua County. They're facing the real pressure on them. But, I think that is something to take into consideration as we're going forward. But maybe that's also a good reason to have more conservation land so you can spread around where people are going. You know, I could keep making the point that if we had enough large tracts of conservation land, and people come up here for 4 or 5 days like they do to Withlacoochee down, you know, just south of us from, and people come from Orlando and Tampa there and spend 3 or 4 days and then using all the resources around there, and there's a great economic benefit from that. And I think relatively low impact compared to what other possible uses could be for that land.
Well, I do have to say, having had to work in other places around the state and talked with other people that come to Gainesville regularly for Gator Games or for university things, I've had multiple comments about how beautiful this area is with the tree canopy and the conservation lands here, and the amount of publicly owned land in Alachua County is huge compared to most other counties in Florida, with Paynes Prairie and other places. So, you know, in some ways we are kind of a vector for being a good example of what a county could be, even though we're here trying to discuss, you know, the how we could be better. In a lot of ways, we are seen as being a very green place in many ways.
Although I'll counter that a little bit. I mean,
if you looked at
the number of counties in the state, and there's 67. I think we're 37th or 38th. I mean, overall, number of conservation lands. Yeah, I mean, I got the numbers from the Florida Natural Areas Inventory.
Of course, I'm talking about people from Tampa and Orlando, so.
Well, I think Hillsborough County may even have more land in conservation land certain than we do. It's a little bit deceptive. One of the great things for, you know, Gainesville and Alachua County is sort of the idea that there's a lot of conservation land clustered right up near the community, so we sort of have the sense that there's much more land in conservation than there really is. And then per capita, obviously, I think there is quite a bit of conservation land per resident. But, you know, when you're looking at an overall number of acres in protection, you know, it's 560,000 acres and 110,000 acres in conservation. It's relatively low. And when you talk about sea level rise, and I really do believe there's a push towards people moving to this area, you know, long term, they're buying the land now, you're going to see more of a crisis. So right now, it's really time to be making a move on that stuff.
Yeah, and I think it's not only going to be sea level rise, but also weather, climate disruption as well, is going to push people away from the coast. But
Tom made the point I was going to make, but I'll put a number on it. And this comes from a really fine article written by Tom Hochter for the Tampa Bay Times called "How Much Land to Protect," and it's, you know, it's about the debate that arose from Amendment 1, but statewide, about 29% of the state of Florida is already in some conservation status. Now, I want to note a lot of that is around military bases, for example, but it is protected, you know, for those strategic purposes, so to speak. So if Alachua County is down at, you know, 20% is what you said, then we're actually below average. And, you know, I think a lot of it is that it's visible. It's right there on I-75, or it's right there on 441, and you can actually see it, but it isn't an extraordinary percentage. I know for a fact that because of the Ocala National Forest,
for us. Marion County has a higher percentage, much higher percentage in conservation. So the other thing, just for whatever it's worth, because I was meeting with a member of the legislature today, and I had all of my data together, and the highest percentage of Amendment 1 support was in Palm Beach County, and in general, those South Florida counties, which are very heavily urbanized, were the highest percentages. Alachua County was at 72.1%, which was slightly lower than average. We were, average, it was 74.9%. Marion County was a little bit above Alachua County.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, for whatever it's worth.
We need to start wrapping up, and so I'd like to finish with a question to each of you. Is there a question that you wish you or another member of the panel had been asked so that we can address things that we might not have addressed yet? What question should I have asked you that I didn't ask? And how would you like to answer that? Yeah, I want to start with you, Tom.
I guess one thing is, what are the, here's a question for all of us to think about is, you know, what are alternatives for trying to conserve land? What other alternatives are out there? I mean, I've got a couple ideas that we could throw out there, but I'd throw that out as one option. What are the alternatives to sort of the traditional ways we've been doing this, you know, assuming all funding dried up for this, and, you know, in certain incentives, like the conservation easement incentive for donated conservation easements going away. What are the alternatives for conserving land?
And did you have an answer?
I think there's a few of them out there. I mean, I would say one of the big ones that maybe wasn't touched upon at all tonight, and that's why I think Alachua County's done so well, is partnerships. You know, we've, as an organization, we've partnered now with the county and the Watermen's District and the state, but with Conservation Trust for Florida, another nonprofit, Putnam Land Conservancy, which is just east of us. I mean, I think that's the other thing that sort of gives this idea that, you know, we've got a lot more conservation lands because we've got so many organizations doing it, trying to do conservation in our community. I think so the idea of doing partnerships is one possibility, you know, whether it's with other organizations, but also with corporations. You know, I talked about the voluntary program for potentially for carbon sequestration as a possibility, but trying to work on that. And I think you're seeing a lot more of that. I mean, so many of the new businesses are reaching out to you know, organizations like us and other organizations that are doing conservation work to try to make that happen in our community. So I think that's one alternative. And then, you know, I think, you know, government's trying to figure out other solutions possibly for, you know, making, you know, conservation viable. I think a big concern is, you know, if the tax benefit for charities goes away, you know, that we start paying property taxes for conservation lands, I think you see real issues. But they're dealing with those in other places like Arkansas. They have to pay their taxes on it, although it's low. You know, how are we going to deal with that? I think that's, again, where partnerships, whether it's with the community itself saying we value this stuff, or, you know, corporate partnerships or other kind of partnerships come into play to make that happen.
Is there an opportunity there in terms of economic development and how we bring corporations into Alachua County?
I think so. I mean, look at when we sell ourselves as a community, when people start, look at any of the businesses, like, you know, I remember, and they're maybe not the best example because they're out of business now, but for other reasons, but, you know, I mean, Groove Shark was a good example. I mean, these guys, one of the big selling points was, you know, it's the quality of life in our community. We use that all the time, and so I think it's really, really, you know, necessary to keep that in the back of our minds when our legislators are saying we've got enough conservation land. You know, says who? I mean, I think it's a huge part of what makes this place so awesome. You know, when I made my chart of places where I was going to come back to live, like Payne's Prairie was like number three on there. And I think it's really important for us to remember that you know, what makes this place so awesome, why people want to come to school here, stay after they finish school here, and why people want to move here and start businesses is because we have these incredible open spaces nearby, and we value it as a community. And I think that needs to be reinforced over and over again.
Thank you. Anybody want to add anything to that, or just move on to the next question?
Well, I had another thought. It was brought up several times that conserving one piece of land, either buying it or with a conservation easement is often not enough to keep it conserved because of impacts from adjacent land that has not been conserved. And we didn't really talk about potential solution. Well, we talked a little bit about it, but an example that strikes us home to me is San Pelasco Hammock State Preserve. It's 7,000 acres. It's pretty big. It ought to be viable. And after it was bought, it was pretty nice. The man named Ellison Hardy was the district chief for the Department of Natural for the park system for this region, and he got his people to eliminate wild hogs from San Pelasco Hammock. For about 20 years, there was no wild hogs. The ground cover was beautiful. And hardly any invasive plants. But then a subdivision went in, the Hammock subdivision, and some of those people planted invasive exotic plants of several kinds. And so they've been spreading out into the Hammock, and people have spent thousands of hours trying to battle them. And it's a never-ending battle. So one obvious solution for that would be to have rules prohibiting the use of known invasive exotic plants, either throughout the entire county, throughout the entire state, or certainly within certain distance of conserved wildlands, perhaps. I'm not big on how to devise laws, but that would be one potential solution. The hogs was an interesting situation. An adjacent neighbor, who's a hunter, I suppose, decided to bring in a truckload of wild hogs and turn them loose on his property next to San Pelasco Hammock, knowing full well where they would go. And he's probably been hunting wild hogs ever since, to his delight and to the detriment of 7,000 acres of public land ever since. So adjacent property can have enormous impacts, and depending on what the adjacent property owners do to public lands. And it's something we need to consider.
So the question that I think we all should be asking ourselves and need to think about this evening is, you know, I've looked at tons of polling data. It's something I do for the Trust for Public Land. I've obviously run for and been elected to office 4 times. And as we've been discussing, I think this community, you know, sort of stands apart in certain ways. But I think it's becoming sort of more and more divided. And you look out in this audience and it's, you know, almost all sort of older, white, upper income folks. And that does not a movement make in today's society. I mean, we have to engage people across all, you know, ages, races, business interests, or, you know, nonprofit or education or whatever. And people need to be, we're not going to convince them only that they should be interested in our issues without being interested in theirs. And I see a lot of problems around that in the conservation community in general. It is something that we worked extremely hard on with Florida's Water and Land Legacy, and I was really pleased that we were able to get, you know, the NAACP and Hispanic Chambers of Commerce and many Republican leaders who came on board and were actively involved in that campaign. But we don't do enough of that in the conservation community, and if we continue to not do enough of that, we will ultimately not see these goals realized, because all of these decisions, whether you like it or not, you know, we can stave off some of the problems here in Alachua County, but we are, you know, very much affected by what happens in our state capital and in Washington. And I'm here to tell you folks, it's not going this direction that we're talking about here at all. I mean, we talk about climate change as though, you know, it's definitely happening, and these are the things we have to do to address it. None of us could run for president on the Republican ticket, because, I mean, even Governor Bush, who I know personally to be a very intelligent man, is saying, yes, it's happening, but it's not happening because of people. we have a serious disconnect between what scientists say and what politicians say. And I have the unusual experience of having been both an engineer and a politician. And it's disturbing. And we have to become more active on that issue.
I particularly appreciate your comments about social equity and sustainability, because sustainability embraces in its full definition the idea of social equity. And so that, you know, if I could ask you one follow-up question to that, what would be a solution that you could propose in terms of addressing social equity and conservation of natural resources?
Well, I would go back to what I talked about earlier, is how do we sort of work on, you know, public policies or programs or game plans that address, you know, multiple issues at the same time. And, you know, I know that our elected officials, many of whom are here in this room, are concerned about all of those issues. I mean, I know they struggle with, you know, how do we address mental health issues? How do we reduce the costs of you know, jailing people who shouldn't be in jail? How do we appropriately police the community without, you know, overspending to do it, and so on and so forth? But I think we have to sort of proactively bring together, you know, people with diverse interests to the table and say, how can, you know, here are the conservation goals we have, here are the social goals we have, here are the economic goals we have, how do we sort of marry those together? And I think that dialogue is really important, and we shouldn't come to it with, you know, our own one set solution. We have to be open to other people's solutions as well.
And I'm going to just bother you one more time. As someone that was elected to office four times, you obviously did engage parts of the community that are not represented in this room in order to be elected. How did you do that? What was your action? Could we ask how you did that? Because that's something we're missing. How can we? I asked to engage other parts of the community, and we tried to actively go after churches and other groups to try to bring a more diverse group of people into this audience. But it did work. So.
Yeah, I mean, you have to go to other organizations and individuals. You can't, you know, expect them to always come to you. And that was, I mean, that's what all these elected officials do as well. I mean, I guarantee you, when Commissioner Cornell was running for office, he spent every Sunday going to African American churches. I did too, you know. And actually, for whatever it's worth, it's good politically. It was also, for me personally, good for my faith, because it's interesting to see how, you know, the wide variety of how different people worship. It's you know, really an interesting and uplifting thing to do. And, you know, I spent a year or two on the board of the Chamber of Commerce, you know. So, I mean, you got to do what you got to do in order to get done what you want to get done. So.
Good advice. Good advice.
Mary, can I just quickly speak to that? Because I got here late. I was at a Reichenhaus graduation in
that conference. Well, Ken, can I just hold you off just a second? Because this is actually, I had to tell everybody at the beginning, this is an EPAC meeting, and so we have to wait for public comments at the end due to our EPAC rules. But we only have one more comment left, and then we will be at the end of the meeting. So if I could just defer to Mark, and you can hold that thought.
I'll give it to you, Ken, here soon. I'll keep it short. I think the one thing that we need to really celebrate is the synergies, and we've been kind of talking about this. So natural resources is just one layer of that, but it crosses over to energy, to economics, to livability, to health. And if we can put those synergies in a way that engages people, and one idea I would have is, particularly when we talk about the matrix next to conservation areas, is if we have good signage that really discusses these synergies and how the role of each individual decision impacts not only their home, yard, neighborhood, but surrounding natural areas. And for example, if we're going to talk about energy conservation, we don't talk about energy conservation in terms of, you know, saving energy and carbon. We talk about how much your utility bill goes down.
Right. Economics.
And so, yeah, so if you put it that way, and that tree, that native tree that's next to your window, is preventing the sun loading into your home, which decreases the utility, which saves you money. So there are ways to do it. We just need to put it visible. And I think with social media, there's opportunities for that. With, I don't know, but I think websites are out the
window now. I'm not sure. So. But something visible, something really in people's day-to-day activities, not peripheral, not having to come to a room like this to learn about, but actually learn in their own neighborhoods.
Right. That's a good suggestion. Okay, so at this point, I would like to invite the elected officials and or other folks that are here. I see Chris Byrd from EPD. Anyone else like to add to this discussion right now? I will happily give up the mic. Ken, I know you had something
sure.
to say.
Sure. Well, I was just going to speak to that point. So it's like that. I came from the Riker House graduation. I would also commend you back for having it in the health center in East Gainesville. Unfortunately, on Wednesday nights, there are many folks at our church. And so. So from that standpoint, Wednesday nights are probably the worst nights to engage the entire community. And so that's a point. What I heard in the brief time that I was here for the last 20 minutes is that natural resources are only going to become more and more valuable as the population of Florida continues to grow. And so that asset that we cherish and that we have, we must, in times like now, continue to try to acquire and protect, because these assets are going to grow in value, and I believe exponentially, same as water. I think those are areas where we've got to figure out how to get it right, and if we can do that, then our community will be a secure community from the standpoint of the saturation. So those are my three comments. And I won't speak to the other two.
Any other comments? Hutch, do you have anything you'd like to say, or Mike? No? Okay.
Yeah, I'll just say I was late also. I'm sorry. Believe it or not, at the Chamber of Commerce Business Recruitment, we were encouraging a person who was going to do high-tech mixing of animal feed to locate in the community. And earlier in the day, I was at a meeting with Senator Bradley and Keith Perry all about water issues and spending on Amendment 1. So what's interesting about being an elected official is virtually every conversation that we have ends up being something about environment and natural resources. Because even this guy who's into mixing high-tech feed was asking questions about water and feeding operations and water pollution, and that very much came into the picture. And what was interesting is that the folks from the Chamber and the University of Florida and stuff had good information about it, good conversations about it. So sustainability factors into the business decisions that the community is making also. And I was very heartened to see that. And then with respect to our legislators, one of the conclusions that I came to was that budget chaos is not necessarily our end. And that there's maybe some hope coming out of the budget chaos in Tallahassee, that some good things might happen, because there's a lot of folks that are using this opportunity to slip in projects, some good, some bad, but there is some hope that some changes will be made in the way that we'll be going this funding and the projects that we're used to. So I came away much more encouraged than I went into those meetings.
Thank you.
Any
other folks from the county that would like to speak? Okay. Any of the EPAC committee members would like to have any comments? All right. Then if we could take just very short comments from the audience, if they would like to make them, we would like to keep that limited so we can get out of here. But this is normally the time in an EPAC meeting that we would open the meeting up for comments from the public.
Just listening tonight and being here for many years, I kind of back up and I say, we're not getting the whole picture, I don't
know. Can you identify yourself, please?
Excuse me?
Can you identify yourself?
I'm Jim McFarland.
Thank you, Jim.
Resident of Gainesville, Florida. A very concerned environmentalist, very concerned with our coast all the way around, very concerned with the fact that Gainesville is sitting in probably the most critical area of all, water flowing into three different water management districts. We're losing fish on one coast, we're losing fish on the other. The pollution that we're creating in our city, the runoff, is something that we need to address. So our natural resources are affecting not just Alachua County. And I think we've got to look at this, because tonight I've sat here and it kind of bothers me, because we're all looking at how much more we can develop and sustainability in developing. And in 1978 is when my my teaching experience brought me the realization that sustainability was not ever going to be reached. And we're past the places I learned in New York City, we're looking at a coastal restoration, that sustainability is not even there, what we're doing. We have got to look at restoring. We need to make some sort of direction of, if we're going to develop something, it has to be zero impact to improving the conditions. Not, we're going to develop more and we'll charge an impact fees because we'll send it off to another generation.
And thank you for that. As somebody that has embraced some of the green building certifications, there is a movement towards building buildings that actually give back to the environment versus those that take away. So that is a good point. Are there any other public comments? Yes, Karen.
I just want to say I really agree with what he says, that we need to focus on restoration.
Can you speak up just a tad?
I'm sorry.
And identify yourself, please.
My name is Karen Arrington, and I agree with what Mr. McFarland said about focusing on restoration. I don't know much about this, Mary, and you can correct me, but I know the Living Building Challenge, which is a green building located, I think, in Seattle. I'm not quite sure. But I think they're focusing on less on, I think they really discourage building on green fields. And I'd like to see the county and the city do an inventory of vacant buildings and maybe kind of use them for different purposes than we're originally, using those. We have a lot of vacancy, and I just think we could use that instead of always going out to green fields. I believe in brownfields and gray fields, but anyway, I know it's a lot more complicated than that. So anyway, thanks.
Well, thank you. As an urbanist, I appreciate the reuse and the use of what's already there. Any other public comments? Well, in that case, I would like to ask someone from EPAC to make a motion for adjourning the meeting.
So adjourning.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Thanks, everyone. If we could please give our panelists a round of applause. And thank you all for coming. And I have to mention one more time, thanks to Papa John's for donating over $100 worth of pizza. That was super nice of them.
Oh my goodness, I'm actually trying to wean out my paper now, and it's stunning.